Vodka O'Clock.
Hello, everyone. It's Amber Love from Vodka O'Clock Podcast, and this is another special episode of a panel that was recorded at Special Edition New York. So this is the writers' panel with Marguerite Bennett, Greg Pak, Charles Sewell, and moderated by Jim Zub. So take a listen. Let me know what you think. And that pretty much wraps up the special edition coverage that we have at amberonmass.com. So don't forget that you can sponsor the show on the website. Go to patreon.com/amberunmasked. Thanks for listening. Cheers.
So I should go up here. I don't know where the man, the legend, Charles Sewell is, but we're going to get this thing underway.
Nice.
Yeah, he'll be here. He's running on, the Soul Train's running on Soul Time. It's fine. Anyways. Thank you very much. Welcome to New York Special Edition. Hope you guys are having a good day, or you're just enjoying sitting down. We are thrilled to be here, and we love seeing tons and tons of comic fans, comic readers. So, you're here either because you're relaxing your feet, or because you want to find out about comic book writing, or both, and we're thrilled to give you a little bit of information. So, this is our little panel called Pitching and Writing Comic Stories, Writers Unite. Why are you going to listen to us? Well, we're going to tell you who the heck we are first. Let me just go through a bit here. On the far right, lovely, wonderful Marguerite Bennett. Give it up for her. Our faithful sponsor, Lobo, and Asgard Assassin, and many, many more titles. You can find her online at Evil Marguerite. The wonderful Greg Pak. Give it up for him. Creator of Looks Like I'd Like to Save the World, Princess to Save Yourself, which is on sale. At this show for the first time.
Yes, table G9. Or come and find me after the panel.
Good stuff. He's written Action Comics, Batman, Superman, Storm, Hercules, and many, many more titles. Currently missing, but will be coming up at some point. Charles Sewell. Give it up for him, even though he's in absentee. He'll be here.
There he is.
There he is, the man. Oh, okay, give him a clap again, because he's walking up the middle. He wanted the hero's entrance, clearly. What a stud.
High five,
then. High five, and do it down the line. Yeah, that's good. That's good. I like it.
Where's the flaming hoop? He needs the flaming hoop.
He's going to get up to the front. He's going to tear the basketball tie. Anyway, okay. 27, Strange Chapters, Letter 44, Strong Man. He wrote Death of Wolverine. He killed Wolverine. But we still like him. She-Hulk, Superman, Wonder Woman, and Human Swamp Thing. And myself, I'm Jim Zub. Got Kratos ties like Wayward, Skullfingers, and Ancient Miracle. Samurai Jack, Dungeons and Dragons, Figment, Legends of Dark Knight, Red Sonja, all kinds of stuff. So we've written a whole host of titles. We've worked for pretty much every major comic publisher in North America between the four of us.
And some minor ones.
And some minor ones, and that's okay too. And so the first question we always get asked whenever people want to talk to us about comics is, how did you get your start? How did you get here? What is your origin story? So starting over at the right, Audrey, how did you get here? I mean, not just like showing up here on the train, but like.
That's a Kieran Gillen answer.
Nice.
I always knew that I wanted to be a writer. Even from when I was a little kid, my dad would like take computer paper that you still had to like, you know, pull like the tabs off the edges and like flip it and staple it so that I could write and illustrate my own stories. So after I finished up my undergrad, I had rather a crisis of conscience where I realized that, you know, there was no more like, oh, no, it's just, you can just discover yourself. It's like, now you have to. No one is going to do this for you, and you know your clock is only ticking. And so, the following 18 months, I worked three jobs and I wrote a novel. And I used the novel as my entire portfolio to get into a creative writing program at Sarah Lawrence College, just north of the city. And it was there that I met Scott Snyder, who taught a comic writing and graphic novel writing class. I brought him some of my original ideas, and he really responded like very positively to them. And we kept in touch. And a year later, reached out to me and said, you know, I keep thinking, you know, about the story that you turned in, and if this is something that you want, I think you're ready to do this professionally. And, you know, would you like me to make an introduction for you at DC? And so he introduced me to Mike Martz, who was then the head Batman editor. And so then I, you know, jumped through, like, the lovely hoops of fire. How do you take notes? You know, how do you work with an editor? How do you work with an artist? How quickly can you turn around? You know, what are the quality of your pitches? You know, how many ideas can you generate? And how long the attempt is. But they liked my work and hired me formally, and then the very first published comic that I had was the Batman Annual.
Sweet.
Yeah, I like Marguerite, I kind of always wanted to be a writer from the time I was about 9 years old. My hero was Ray Bradbury. You know, I was a kid who read a ton. I was also, when I was a kid, I was one of the kids who drew. So I was always drawing comics, basically. I drew for my various papers in high school and college. But I was always writing. I wrote short stories all the time. One of the things that I read when I was very young that had a big impact on me is the introduction that Ray Bradbury wrote to one of his, to a short story collection. I think the title of the essay was Drunk and in Charge of a Bicycle. But it was basically about his early years as a writer and about the way he, as a young writer, every single week he finished a story. Like, that was the task he gave himself. Every single week he'd write a story. And after doing this for a long time, he finally wrote a story, and it was a story called The Foghorn. And he wrote it, and he was like, I think I finally wrote a good story. And that just kind of turned on a lot of lights in my head, this idea that, you know, like, I have this deep passion to write, but that it was going to take a lot of time, and that was okay. You know, that it was going to take a lot of work and a lot of time, but that was just what it was. And that whole process was going to be exciting and fun, and that's what I should do. So that's what I did. I wrote and wrote and wrote, and I, at a certain point, stopped thinking that I was going to be a writer. When I was in college, I studied political science, and I thought I was going to go into politics. And I actually worked on the Ann Richards campaign when she was running for governor of Texas back in the day, which was great. But you know what? That's not what I was meant to do. And at a certain point, I realized I needed to go back to the things that I needed to be doing. I ended up going to film school. I went to NYU, and I studied film, and I made a bunch of short films, and I made a feature film called Robot Stories after I graduated. And around that time that my agent found out that Marvel was interested in looking at some possible new writers from other, you know, from independent film or from other places. And she said, would that be interesting to you? And I was like, yes. And so I was able to kind of come in sideways from film into comics. Which is sort of where I started as a kid in the first place. So that's the kind of roundabout way I came into it. And once I started at Marvel, I actually worked for about a year just developing stuff. I mean, it took a long time for the stars to align. I actually wrote, I think, 3 or 4 complete scripts for projects that never happened for one reason or another. And they kept assuring me that they loved what I was doing. It was just that, you know, this particular thing wasn't coming together. And I was like, okay. And I just kept going because Ray Bradbury wrote a short story every week, so I was going to keep doing it. And eventually it clicked. I did the Warlock series. I think the first issue that came out in September 2004. And then I got tapped for X-Men Phoenix End Song, which ended up being a pretty big book. And it was at that point that I was like, okay, I think maybe I might be doing this professionally. You know, this is maybe a thing. And then the Hulk was the first ongoing I got on the Planet Hulk storyline. And 10 years later, here I am.
10 years later. Three, Charles.
Well, first of all, I think you should go back into politics, man. You could be our president. Imagine if you were our president.
I'd have to shave, though. I don't know if they're ready for a bearded president.
Nice.
They might not be ready. All right, I've told my origin story a bunch of times, many times on this very panel, but...
Just lie.
I mean, it's long. I mean, I went to law school. I decided I didn't want to go to law school. I graduated from law school. Being a lawyer sort of had its ups and downs and all that. And then, I got into comics and so on and so forth. But, you know, when I think about it, what ultimately really was I just decided that I was going to do this. And all of the sacrifices and money and time and all of the things that would have to be given up in order to get there were worth it. The tricky thing about this is that I know now that absolutely all those sacrifices were worth it. I didn't necessarily know it ahead of time, but when you make the decision, you know, you have to make the decision. And so I think that's basically my origin story. I just decided to do it.
You decided to start running. Decided to put all your efforts and time and sacrifice.
Yeah, if you want to hear the rest of it, I'll tell you, but it's you know, basically that's it. I just decided.
And he wrote himself a contract legally, and he signed it off. All right. So I came into this sort of sideways as well. I love comics, grew up on comics, but I never thought that I would be able to work in it because, as far as I can tell, you had to live in New York City, which works out pretty well if you live here, but I don't. I'm from Toronto, Canada, so I apologize for everything. But I thought that you had to live in New York or be in America in order to write comic books. So I got into animation, because that was my other passion, was animation and animated art, sort of traditional Disney-style artwork and animation. So I trained in that, worked in Canadian animation for several years, and then when there was a lull in work, I ended up hooking up with a group called the Udon Studio, and they were doing all sorts of comic book work and toy design for all kinds of different companies. And I learned about the business. I learned about management and editing and sort of all the bits and pieces that I didn't know at the time, but that I would end up using when I did my own creator-owned stuff. So by the time I pitched sort of my first big creator-owned series for 2000, well, this would have been 2008, and then it was published in 2010, called Skull Kickers, and that really got me sort of, I was doing other work before that, but that was the book that really kind of broke me out and got invisible to a lot of people. And a lot of the other stuff I've done is sort of rolled out from there. You know, each new project, hopefully, you know, kind of expanding and building on it. I think what you sort of notice with all of us is that there's a kind of a buildup of work. In many cases, it's not just about putting out a story or saying, okay, you know, I make a comic book, but it's about understanding or building what we're trying to understand the craft or understand how to make comics. I know in Charles' case, only you get the full breakdown, you did a bunch of short stories.
Yeah, so when you're starting out, I think many of us probably in this room have a 75-issue maxi series. We have our own Sandman, we have our own Preacher, we have our own whatever you want to call it. Yeah, in our heads, it's this book that we've been building for decades, and we're just ready to do it. We can do it right now. The truth is, even if you're that good, no one's going to publish it. So the way that you get noticed is by doing smaller stories. I always tell people, you know, audiences of this panel tend to be sort of ranging from people who are accomplished and have projects ready to pitch now and want to know how to pitch them, to people who are just starting out as writers and want to know literally how to write comics. And I think sort of the same advice can apply to both, right? You know, you can take, you know, a one-page or a two-page story, a script, and then you execute it with an artist in a way that can fully kind of express the idea. So, and it's a lot simpler to do that than your 75-issue maxi series, and when it's done, you have a sample that you can show an editor or something like that. So, you know, you don't have to get everything that you write drawn, because writing is cheap, drawing is expensive, but, you know, let's say you're trying to figure out how to write a comic, you know, give yourself different ideas, right? So I'm going to write a one-page story that's a fight. I'm going to write a one-page story that somebody asks somebody on a date. I'm going to write a one-page story that involves rain. You do those.
Write a three-page story of a date that turns into a fight in the rain.
Yes, absolutely. You know, like, that's great. You should do that. But the point is that you're working on being able to use those skills, because in one 20-page script, you might have to do all of those things and do them all perfectly, but it's like little test cases. They don't take a lot of your time, and you're not spending those 6 months working on that idea. It's just, all right, you know, whatever, whatever. And then as soon as your skill set is there, then you kind of move on and you start doing other things. So that's a very specific thing, but, you know, there's more to it than that.
Absolutely. So, Greg, when you were starting out, you were doing film first. You did, like, short films and scripts and treatments for those?
And what Charles just said applies directly to that, you know. I started film school in 1993, and I thought I was a genius. I might have been. I don't know. It's kind of hard to tell but at this point. But I was not. No, I was not a genius. I had a lot to learn, and I needed to go to a place where people who had no investment in my emotional well-being would tell me what they thought about my work. And that was film school, and it was hard, but it was great. And I made a ton of short films. I made several short films as part of the program that was sort of required by the program. I made several more short films that were just using the equipment and doing it on the side, you know what I mean? By hook or by crook, I just made a ton of shorts. I mean, I think I also ended up doing a series of PSAs for the New York County Medical Association, which was just a kind of crazy thing that I was able to hook on the side. And that was like doing 12 more little short films.
It's like, don't drink gasoline.
Well, it was like, you know, bicycle safety and wear a helmet and stuff. But each one had a little
book, advice.
A little bit of story. Yeah, wear a helmet, kids. But it's very similar to what Charles was talking about. Every one of those little shorts had its own little challenges, and had a story that had a beginning, middle, and an end. So by doing that short thing, it was a thing that I could shoot over a weekend with the small amount of money or the small and the friends that I could scrounge up for a weekend, and we could bang it out, I could get it done, and then I could get it out in the world and see if it worked, and learn from it, and then walk away and do the next thing, you know? As opposed to, you know, working on a single feature film for 20 years.
Realizing that it wasn't working.
Yeah. And also having that thing where the first, you know, like the first three scenes I shot are horrible, and then I get better as the thing goes on. So that by the end, anyway. But I highly recommend that process of doing a bunch of short things and learning from that. I also was drawing comic strips around this time. I drew comic strips for the Korean Times English edition, a strip called American Soul. This was back before web comics, and I actually put them online, you know, years ago. But that was also really educational. And this was before I ever knew that I was going to eventually have a career in comics. But any opportunity I had to do storytelling, I would jump on. You know, I did wedding videos because there was storytelling involved in that. You know what I mean? Like, it sounds kind of crazy, but all of those different things.
Any chance you could get to work with
someone? You were taking classes for writing. You had done a novel before that. And you did a bunch of other writing. How much sort of assignment work did you guys do in that class?
Scott's class was different because it was, you know, there was a portion of it that was reading, you know, not necessarily the canon of graphic novels or comics, but, you know, just sort of a selection of, you know, things that he thought were very accomplished about character or about, you know, about art style, about pacing, you know, about doing things that only comics can do. And so, you know, part of the class was studying sort of like, you know, the text that had come before, and part of it was creating your own and incorporating those lessons. Honestly, you know, it's sort of funny because, you know, it wasn't remotely related to comics, but one of the best classes, most useful for writing, the most useful especially for this medium, was a short story class that I took. Professor named David Hollander, still teaches at Sarah Lawrence, and, you know, he gave us, like, you know, just these few lists for short stories, and it was having to generate a new idea every week. Because you've got, you know, oh, the novel, well, everything suddenly becomes about that character, about that setting, about, you know, that focus theme, and, you know, the second story, the meaning that, you know, you want the readers to walk away with from the book. But having the short stories forced you not to be so precious about it. You can't
get an idea
start,
out,
yeah,
take it from
uh-huh.
start to finish.
I mean, it made you think on your feet a lot, and, you know, you didn't want to be the person who's turned in, like, you know, 40 stories that are all like the slow decline of a suburban marriage. You know, right. So you needed to jump around, you know, style and tell. Yes, absolutely. But I mean, like, that class, I mean, like Scott gave us, like, you know, the building blocks, but in terms of, you know, the finesse, you know, like the short story class was incredibly helpful. And I feel like the combination of those two was really what helped me, you know, make an impression.
The other thing that short story class sounds like was amazing too, and sort of directly applicable, particularly to work for Higher Comics, in the sense that ideas are cheap. Like, you have to have tons and tons of ideas. You know, like, for any published story that you guys might read, there were probably anywhere from 3 to 10 different ideas that were pitched. You know what I mean? And different variations of that idea that you published, or maybe completely different ideas.
Greg and I worked together on a huge storyline for DC called Superman Doomed, which was about sort of kind of a retelling of the whole Doomsday thing, where Superman dies and so on and so forth. And we had, like, many, many in-person meetings at the DC office where we just were like, all right, here's the next arc, what are we going to do? Moving, like, ideas flying like crazy, and then you just sort of whittle it down. So you want as many ideas as you can have, really. They're never going to stop.
Absolutely. But, so once you've got material, once you're starting to build up, want to be able to put that stuff out there. And it used to be like in the 80s or 90s, you would self-publish, or you would do like an Ash King, they used to call them, or you do a small, you know, sort of run of a magazine. But nowadays, it's much, much easier to build and put stuff online. Like, the audience is out there, everyone's online, and the more and more, the kind of barriers to entry are kind of breaking down because you can sort of put the work out directly to a readership. You can build up a readership, and in some cases, you can build a big enough audience that they actually can carry you into other professional work. Like people like Ryan North going from Dinosaur Comics to writing at Marvel, you know, and things like that, sort of building up, you know, ahead of steam and being able to put your work out there online. I did a, my first comic that I made was actually an online comic I made in 2001 to 2002, and I was working away on this thing doing 3 pages a week just for my own kind of methodical, I gotta do this. My day job was not fun. This was an outlet for me to sort of create this thing, and people started reading it and sharing it. And back then it was all about getting people to bookmark your site. Nowadays it's a heck of a lot easier, but slowly building up an audience. And then eventually other people that were making comics reaching out, telling me they liked it, and building up those friendships and that kind of broader social network. But I think what's really sort of true across the board, whether it's, you know, Margaret writing a novel, or Greg doing his films, or Charles doing short stories and stuff, whether it's the subject matter, make sure that you're writing stuff that means something to you. I know it seems like you want it sort of, you think you can game the system or kind of be like, well, I'm going to write something that will blow these guys away, but it's got to be something you care about or are knowledgeable about or are willing to dig deep and research on. Because when it's difficult and when it doesn't work, I think we can also say it just becomes hell to work on. You can't, you know, it's hard to fake being amazing in a particular area or focusing on a genre or a thing that you're not actually passionate about. I mean, you know, obviously you've got your background as a lawyer, but then you've also got all kinds of, you know, your worldly, you travel and you do all kinds of...
The first book I had ever read out through Image is called 27, and 27 is a book about a rock guitarist who basically makes a deal with the devil so he doesn't die at 27 like Jimi Hendrix. It's a hell of a read, very uplifting. And I've been a musician myself since I was 3 years old. My mom had me playing violin at 3. And so I've been in a million bands, I've studied composition, I've done all that stuff. And so when it came time to write a project that I knew that I could write with some authority, and I think that's the key word, right, authority, music was an obvious go-to for me. And yours might not be music, it probably isn't music, I mean, who knows what you've got, but there's something that you know better than anybody else, whether that's washing dishes at a shitty job, whether it's, you know, piloting an airplane, whether it's going, you know, being a grad student, whatever the thing is that you do that you know, you start there, right? And you can layer in other things, but I think authority is something that's very important. And you get it through either life experience, which you have, or you get it through a hell of a lot of homework and research, and that's another way to get it. But writing with authority, readers can feel it, they know it, and it's really, it's crucial to have, even in like superhero stories, like the, you know, the war got a lot, you know, like they're, or you know, fantasy stories or whatever it is, like things that are detached from reality, like find a way to get your authority into it and it'll feel real.
So I guess sort of ties in, I've got a saying I like to, you know, write what you know, but try to know a lot. I think it's about more than just reading comics. Obviously comics are important, we all love it, we all obsess over it, but try and broaden your interests. Read about the world, read the news, travel to places, have experiences, because those are going to interject themselves into your stories as much as possible.
Along those lines, I highly recommend taking, you know, if you have the opportunity to take a job that's a little scary, because you don't quite know it, do it. You know what I mean? Like, I've definitely taken jobs because I wanted to learn more.
You know? You mean like a job or like a writing job?
Like a writing job. I mean, probably that applies to jobs too. Unless it's brain surgery, in which case I highly recommend you actually learn that subject before you take the job. You know, for example, I was offered Magneto Testament, which is a miniseries that I did about Magneto's origin story. And it's a Holocaust story. We did it as a straight historical fiction, made it as historically accurate as we possibly could. And I thought I had a pretty good background to dive into that, just because I had done some, you know, I knew a pretty good amount. I had actually even studied German in high school and college, and I had a pretty good grasp of the history. But there's, you know, a huge amount to learn, and I was scared, you know what I mean? But I kind of thought that being scared was good, you know what I mean? Like, I took a job that would force me to, that would require me to learn a lot and grow, you know what I mean? Like, that's also a big motivation for being a writer, I think. It's just the desire to understand stuff. You know, I think writing is thinking. We're compelled to write because we want to think through stuff that confuses us. I mean, that's one reason. So taking jobs, you know, like...
Is that what, because I never put it in the, like, that's an interesting way to put it. You write because it, one of, I mean, many reasons, right?
Yeah.
But because it helps you think things through the confusion.
I think so, yeah, try to make sense of the world. You know, I mean, like, I mean, writing is, when you write, you're imposing a story on a series of events, you know, those series of events may mean something totally different to somebody else, and they mean nothing at all, but when you put them in a certain order and try to describe them a certain way, you are trying to make sense of it.
When you're working on your books, what sort of research are
you doing? Supposed to be wrong. I mean, probably wrong.
I probably.
I mean, it all varies by project for me.
Sure.
You know, with Bombshells, I wanted to make it an alternate history of World War II, for a variety of reasons. I mean, like, you know, part of it was I wanted to sort of, like, I didn't want the exclusion of characters for queer or characters of color.
Sure.
And for the sake of historical accuracy.
Right.
Which even then, you know, is so horrible and dismissive. Sorry, this is I'll get off this soapbox.
Well, you're right. It's usually wrong because usually those people were there.
Absolutely. But you know, it gets blanked out of the media that you're fed, and the media that you're fed is what you regurgitate as opposed to the actual, you know, history.
Right.
Segging back in. with Bombshells, you know, it was really easy for like the first few months that we were working on to get completely bogged down, you know, just the research sort of at the expense of like the blood and the heat of the story. You know, like what made, you know, you be passionate about it. But it varies by project. I don't have a better answer than that.
If you are an artist and you're able to draw your own story, it's great, more power to you. But if you're not, then you've got to find collaborators. And that's a whole other subject. We could do a whole panel on collaborating with artists and working with other people. But as much as possible, you have to understand that whatever you do is going to be judged based on that artwork. People are going to look for a professional quality page. And it's hard for them necessarily to see a professional quality story if it doesn't have a professional quality art on it.
And lettering. God, lettering is so important.
Make sure it's readable. Make sure you go through and be diligent about making a professional quality work. It's going to be compared to the stuff that you like. It's going to be compared with the publishers that you want to be published by. It has to stand up against that quality bar.
Yeah, anything that you put in front of an editor should be, you should never have to say, well, you know, I was rushed, so don't, like, any of that sort of disclaimering, you just shouldn't be showing it to an editor. Anything you show an editor should be as good as anything that's on the shelf already. Otherwise, there's no point in showing it to an editor. Just do another thing, which goes back to the whole 1-, 2-, 3-page stories, because those don't take a lot of investment, but an editor can be just as impressed by a 1-page story as he can be by a 20-page story. And your investment of time and money and everything is a lot less on that 1-page.
Absolutely. So if you've got an idea, once you've built up some understanding of the form and you've got a sense of the craft, now you need to try and get your idea or show it to a publisher or give them a sense of what you want to do for a concept, and that involves pitching. Pitching is different than the writing process, but it does share, obviously, a lot of different elements. And the question you're trying to answer in a pitch is, why should a publisher choose your comic or your story over someone else's? If they have to choose between all these different things, what do you have that is interesting or unique or is so well polished or so well put together that it's inviting, it's engaging, that they're going to want to publish it? You have to organize and sum up your ideas into a short and concise pitch. I think this is one of the most common mistakes I see when people want to tell me about their stories. They assume that complexity equals professionalism. And so they want to bring like a giant 400-page telephone book and drop it in front of someone and go, this is my magnum opus, you have to, you know, this is going to change your life. But the reality is, if you think about it for a minute, you empathize and you realize, wait a minute, if I was an editor, I can't look at 400-page documents, I can't look at even a 10-page document or a 20-page document every single time I want to see if someone's got a good idea. It's got to be short. It's got to be concise, and it has to be an idea that you can sum up and deliver and communicate.
Should we do those?
Do you want to do
one last? Yeah.
Do you have a pitch?
I can quickly. So I have this series called Letter 44 that I'm working on now. It's a creator-owned series out there, Running Press. It's been going for a while. Super quick pitch, like what I would tell someone, just like what's about. I would say, a U.S. president gets elected, finds out that the previous president's administration found aliens in the asteroid belt, covered it up. So now it's his problem to deal with. You know, it's done. It's one sentence, and you can sort of see what that story is about, and off you go.
Yeah, pitch.
Yeah, well, back in the day, I wrote Planet Hulk, And the quick pitch for that is the Hulk gets shot off into space by the heroes of Earth, who decide it's too dangerous for Earth. He ends up on an alien planet where he goes from slave to gladiator to conquering emperor. And that's the story.
Mighty fine pitch. You got one more, Marguerite?
Yeah, maybe I should talk about it because it's not announced or out yet. But
okay.
I'm going to do it anyway.
Uh-oh. Uh-oh. Like your ears on the panel?
No, it's creator owned, so
okay,
fine.
Okay. Go for it.
It's the story of a nightmare that falls in love with the person having it.
Nice.
And it's a psychosexual descent to madness.
Well, I mean, are they all?
I want to read that. That sounds awesome.
Oh, you got that.
You just got 30 subscribers.
And then I'm
going
to
get that. That's awesome. No, it's good stuff. I really like that. So I've got a series I'm doing right now, an image called Wayward. And the easiest way I can explain it is it's a bit like Buffy in Japan. So it's teenagers fighting Japanese mythological monsters on the streets of Tokyo. So it's sort of like the generational divide in Japan, only with traditional Japanese monsters. And so it's about taking this broader idea, taking this, and it's a all these stories are very complex, and they've got tons of moving parts, and they may have dozens of characters, but you're just distilling all that down into a sentence, or three sentences, or a handful of paragraphs that really drive that home. Because what you want is, you don't want a publisher to look at this thing, be intimidated, or just go, yeah, whatever, get to the point, and stop reading. You want them to read it almost breathlessly and go, okay, now what? Like, I want more, or I'm engaged. Tell me how this thing all happens. You're like, great, here's more information. Now I can give you an expanded outline. Now I can tell you all the different pieces, because you're an engaged audience that wants it, rather than just hammering them with too much information and too much complexity. If anything, it's about just saving them the time. Even if they decide they don't want to go ahead with a pitch, I found it can be actually really valuable to have a nice, professional, concise pitch. Because even if they turn it down, they're going to appreciate that you didn't waste their time and that you're a professional that they might want to work with in the future.
Also, you can, and then they'll say, what else do you have?
Right.
I mean, the value of a really short pitch, too, is that they can say, so you can say, you know, I've got this Hulk story, it's a gladiator, you know,
yeah.
Gladiator, Hulk, and the alien planet. They're like, we just need Gladiator, Hulk, and the alien planet. What else you got?
Right.
You got them to say what else you got.
And that means they're interested in your ideas. They want to hear more. Absolutely. You've got to remember that it is fun, and it is fanboyish and exciting, but it's also a job and a possible career. You have to treat this like a career. And the easiest way for me to explain that is sort of like, if you were on the other end, if you were the editor, and you were going to invest a bunch of time and potentially a bunch of money, and if things went horribly wrong, put your job on the line, would you hire you? Are you giving them a compelling reason or professional quality that would push them over the edge, or are you just flailing and saying, I really want this? You know, the analogy I always use is, when it comes to creative efforts, I feel like sometimes people forget that this is a job, or they forget about professionalism. They just sort of, if they wanted to be a chef, it's the equivalent of running into the restaurant and just going, hey, can I be your chef? And they go, why? Well, I love food, and I watch the Food Network, and I've always wanted to be a chef. It's my dream. And they go, well, have you ever cooked? No, but dude, I love food. Okay, but like, can you make food? Well, I'm going to, and I've always wanted to, and if you give me a chance, I'll do it for you. Pay me, and I'll do it. Yeah, that's not how this works, man. Like, you've got to build stories. You got to get better at it. You have to basically prove that you can make consistent professional quality work before someone's going to pay you to do it for them. That's the simple truth.
Yeah.
All right. So some broad stuff that we, I think as a whole, you kind of learn about as you work in this business. Some stuff we wish we knew when we were getting our start. I think the industry is more accessible than ever before. I know all four of us are on Twitter.
Yeah.
And Facebook. We're out at more conventions, and there's conventions running every single week. I don't know about you guys, but the social end of things, or the ability to interact with people, has really changed.
Yeah. Also, there are a lot of creators who have posted copies of their scripts online, who have do breakdowns of how an issue came together. Folks like, Fred Van Lente and I wrote a book called Make Comics Like the Pros, which is everything that you need to know.
They can buy that at this very convention.
Well, you can buy them
G9.
Right after this panel.
It's actually right across from my table.
Exactly.
It also has some good stuff.
Yes.
So, anyway.
And folks like Brian Michael Bendis have written how-to books. Gail Simone put together a Tumblr, which has tons of practical advice about making comics on it. Yeah, there's...
I've got a bunch of tutorials on my site. Oh, I've got script samples, pitch samples. I've got sort of how to pitch. I've got how to sell stuff at conventions, all kinds of things. Charles has got a killer series.
It's called Agree to Agree. It's on my blog, which is just, you can get it at charlesholt.com or whatever. But it's, you know, my other career, my day job, so to speak, is being an attorney. And so I wrote up a whole bunch of posts about, you know, when you enter into a collaborative agreement with a writer, a letterer, artist, colorist, whatever, it's kind of what those agreements should look like. When you're talking to a publisher and you sign over your ideas, what you should be looking for in those agreements. I mean, you know, I as a trained contract reading guy, that's what they call lawyers, trained contract reading guy. That's the professional term.
As a
trained contract reading guy, you know, I mean, you know, you can understand a deal on the page, but yet there's a whole, like, another layer of what it could actually mean for you professionally in the business, and sort of interpreting all that is really, frankly, difficult. It's very much an experience thing, and I there are decisions I made early in my career that I would probably not make now. But anyway, yeah, Agree to Agree. It's on my blog. You know, there's a whole bunch.
Networking is easier than you think. Marguerite's the master of this. As of last night, she's the master. Master. It's awesome. Anyways, networking is easier than you think. Tell us. Tell us about your network. Yeah, tell us about just sort of the social end of LinkedIn. Whatever.
Oh, good job.
Well, not. Don't say anything illegal here, but.
Sorry.
No. I'm putting you on the spot. I apologize.
It's okay.
But the reality is that a lot of us, there's a social component to any industry, there's a social component to your job and whatever you do. And there's one here as well, and I think it's built on an idea of mutual respect, and it's built on an idea of, you know, being a cheerleader for each other's work and excited about what we do. And going out and talking about and supporting each other, that's all part and parcel of this thing.
One of the biggest things I can say along those lines is cast your bread upon the water.
Yeah.
You know, do unto others. You know, like, the more you, you know, it's not, like, make friends and support good work, and folks will support your work, you know what I mean? Like, the best thing that will sell your work is other respected writers and artists saying it's good. In public, you know?
But the thing about that, right, is that so everybody in the audience here, you might look at Jim and say, hey, Jim's very accessible. He's a guy that I can go talk to. It's not true. He will, as soon as his panel's done, he's not your friend. He won't talk to you. But the people who are in your row, you know, maybe they will. You know, everyone in this room is aspiring to become a comic creator. And my theory of this is that you can access someone on your rung of the ladder, anyone below you, and then someone one rung above you. Maybe if you get really lucky, you can hit somebody two rungs above. But you're not going to go up to Axel Alonso, who's editor-in-chief of Marvel, or, you know, Bob Harris, who's editor-in-chief of DC. They're just not going to pay any attention to you. But, you know, you all climb that ladder together, so the people on the rungs around you are all climbing up. And just as Greg pointed out, like, I think any of the four of us on this panel, we all read and really respect each other's work, and we give each other a nod or a retweet or, like, you know, or you know, a mention to an editor or whatever the support is, because we've all kind of come up together and we know how hard it is, and we all have, as part of that, have read and enjoyed each other's work. So, you know, don't, I mean, shoot for the stars if you want to, but really it's the relationships you're building right now at your level that will pay dividends forever.
It's not something where you can walk into the room and just say, oh, who's the most powerful person? It is about talk to everyone, interact with everyone. You have no idea. First of all, you're going to make tons of great friends, and then you're going to realize how much you all have in common in terms of being creative and wanting to do things. But you have no idea where you're going to be 5 years from now, 10 years from now. Some of the people that I work with now are people that I grew up through this industry with. One of the first shows that I did with Skullkickers, it was Charles and Curtis Reed and who else was there? Nate Edmondson and Brian Glass, and we all went in for dinner that night because we were celebrating that we had our books that had just come out. And we went for dinner and we were like, hey, this is so cool. We're all kind of at the same level. We should look out for each other.
Yeah. You know who Eugene Sun, who is a TV writer who works on some of the Marvel animated shows, he was on Twitter the other day talking about networking. And he put networking in quotes.
Sure.
Because the whole idea is that if you're networking, then it's probably not working. But if you're meeting people who share an interest and who are coming up in the world, and yeah, he was talking about in college, that the people he was hanging out with and doing creative stuff with in college, just because they were the cool people that he wanted to do stuff with, they were his friends, that those people eventually, they all grew and became people who helped each other out professionally. You know what I mean?
You don't look in the want ads and see comic book writer wanted. You know what I mean? That's not this kind of job. It's very much where someone, you know, hears about or says, oh, we need someone for this project, and then someone else says, hey, I know who'd be the perfect fit for that. You know, John Barber was a guy who was making webcomics at the same time I was back in 2001, and we both sort of commiserated that we liked each other's stuff, and we chatted back and forth. I didn't know that, like, 14 years later, John was going to be one of the lead editors at IDW, and when they were talking about the Dungeons & Dragons license, he goes, I know the biggest fantasy nerd. We got to get Jim. He's going to write the shit out of this book. But it just so happened that our mutual love of comics, you know, 13 years earlier, paid dividends I couldn't have possibly imagined. You know what I mean? And that's the long game.
Yeah, it's a long game. That's exactly what I was going to say. Absolutely. It's a long game. Or a long con, if you want to look at that.
Okay, so sorry, the word networking threw me, because that's what conjures the, like, the image of everyone sitting around, like, you know, in a business lounge, and like, okay, here's a card for you, and a card for you, and a card for you.
Just not
No, I mean, you know, for me, it is socializing. You know, it was me and James Tynan going out, like, for lunch, like, the day after I was, you know, announced on, like, the Batman annual. Or friends that I had, you know, in Scott's class, like, one of whom's now an assistant editor at Marvel, Christina Harrington, and works with me on Years of Future Past, on this whole book. And, you know, I guess, like, a big part of it was, like, don't be a hater. Like, you know, support good work, support good people. But no, it's, I feel like I'm kind of, like, you know, now echoing, like, the sentiments that have been shared because they've all rung true. You know, where, like, the folk that you start with, the folks who go through, you know, sort of, like, the foxhole with you. are the people, you know, who are going to have your back for the rest of your career. You know, there have been times, you know, where creators, you know, they've come up with projects or, you know, have gone through controversies that I might not have agreed with. But, like, I know that person now, you know, and I know what they're capable of. I know the heights and, like, you know, and I'll stay with them and, you know, and have their back. And I hope they have mine when I do the same.
And I think when I said, you know, you're like the master network, and what I meant was every time I've gone out with you in a group, it's like, gracious and you're kind and you're supportive and you know everyone's name and you're interacting and you're excited about the work, and that carries over. It has a really positive net effect.
That
on
is very
you
kind.
And on everyone around. Absolutely.
When you said that, like, you know, it put me on the spot. I was like, I'm good at this because I sing a really
about?
Good Johnny Cash karaoke.
Here's another thing that I think is so true. When you're on a creative journey, when you're on any kind of career building sort of goal, you don't necessarily appreciate where you're at in the here and now. Be very much a grass is greener type scenario where you're constantly looking and saying, I wish I was doing what that person was doing. I wish I was Greg Pak. I wish I was Charles Soule. I wish I was Marguerite Bennett. I wish I was doing, you know, a particular project or a particular announcement or a big thing at this moment. And you can really build up a lot of kind of venom if you get overly concerned with that and you don't appreciate the strides that you're making in terms of your own growth, your own development, your own skills, and really appreciate where you're at. You know, if you are able to get a story published, and you really relish that, and use that momentum and that joy to build off of it to the next goal and the next thing. I find a lot of people, they get so obsessed with the next goal or the next milestone that they don't have any sense of their own current spot on the path. Bigger or smaller isn't necessarily better. I know that everyone wants to, you know, you may have these goals of working for the biggest companies or doing really big projects, but that doesn't necessarily, it's not a one-to-one ratio in terms of satisfaction. You can have very personal projects, very small projects that hold a lot of meaning to you. You can do big corporate stuff and it might be amazing, but there's everything sort of in between. And I think as we go along this journey and we get different kind of opportunities, you sort of realize you've got to judge each kind of project and opportunity on its own merits.
Yeah, I think also, you know, it took me almost 10 years to get from the point where when I made the decision that I mentioned at the beginning of the panel, like deciding I wanted to do this, to when my first issue of Swamp Thing came out from DC, But you know, so you think, oh my God, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years to make it, so to speak. But really, every one of those, you like, that was a blast the whole time. I mean, you're coming up, you're hanging out with your buddies, you're all going through the same things. It's really great. So don't be afraid of the fact that it takes a huge amount of time, an endless amount of time and effort. And frustration,
yeah.
And money, and all of those things.
If it wasn't, I mean, you put yourself into it because you care, because you want to do great work.
Also, I mean, sometimes the dream project, it's very good that the dream project doesn't happen when you want it to happen.
Yeah.
I've got a thing that I've been...
You sort of zen about it.
Yeah, well, no, because, you know, I've got a project that I wanted to do literally 22 years ago. And hopefully we're going to announce it very soon. But I'm so glad that I didn't do it back when I wanted to do it, because, yeah, it's grown and I've grown and it's become something better, you know? So sometimes, you know, sometimes that stuff just needs to percolate.
I know this sounds corny and it sounds very kind of, you know, self-help kind of whatever, but like, your passion and your hard work do pay off. You may not necessarily get exactly what you want, when you want, the way you thought you were going to get it, but if you continue to work, opportunities will open up. A lot of the goals that I thought I was going to be a Disney animator when I started on this creative journey, and I didn't get to do that, but the opportunities that opened up because I worked hard and because I wanted to be that have been wonderful. And in a weird roundabout way, last year I did a Disney project. I wrote the Figment miniseries, and I worked with the Disney Imagineers, and it was a weird kind of roundabout way of getting what I always wanted in a way I never imagined. You know what I mean? And I think that's the kind of thing where you can't just, this isn't the kind of job where you're going to go, I want to be a firefighter, I go train to be a firefighter, I'm a firefighter. You're going to go and you're going to have all sorts of weird ups and downs and roller coaster ride, but the passion and the hard work does lead you to something amazing. If you want to make comics, if you want to do this as a career, you've got to support great work. Creator-owned comics live and die on your recommendations, your grassroots support, and you buying titles. If you want an industry to be there that's going to support you, you've got to support them. So find great books, tell people about great books, share them with your friends, support this industry so it's there for you when you come around with your creative projects. Alright? So, we covered a lot of different stuff here. We've got our tables listed there on the side and our contact info if you want to track us down on our websites or tweet us at some point or find us here at the show. We've got a few minutes, fleeting minutes, for a question if someone wants to come up to the mic and ask us something.
There we go.
All right.
You sound great. Hello.
First off, I want to say, Jim, I hope to be a fan of you soon.
Cool.
The three of you. I love everything you guys have done so far.
Very kind.
another friend of mine I joked about before was the idea that when you guys do yourself at the bigger companies, you kind of using their characters as kind of them and their toys, and then when you get your creator own stuff, you know, your own thing. So of your creative own companies, what's your like favorite projects that you guys have done?
Choose between your children. Yeah. Do it now.
I love Lot 44. It's the one that I mentioned about the president, the aliens. It's like House of Cards in space. I just adore it. You know.
I've got The Princess Who Saved Herself is the children's book that actually is being sold here for the very first time. We did a Kickstarter for it. It's about a kick-ass proactive princess who's in a big conflict over her guitar playing. The witch down the street doesn't like her guitar playing. Whatever I'm doing right now, whatever I've just done is always my favorite child.
And mine is, that's not what I mentioned, but I can say that it's the story that made Scott take notice of me and made my parts start getting my first job.
Awesome. I've got,
thank you.
Yeah, working on Wayward for me has been an absolute thrill. I get to take something I'm really passionate about, which is like mythology and culture, and then put this Japanese spin on it.
You develop your creator-owned work. Do you tend to write out the whole story, like you have your scripts ready, or do you make your pitch, and then wait on writing it?
different for different projects.
Yeah, absolutely.
For The Princess Who Saved Herself and for Code Monkey Save World, we did those as Kickstarter projects, so we didn't have to go get approval from an editor. Those particular projects just, I worked on them with Jonathan Colton, who was my partner. He's the guy who wrote the songs that those are based on. And we agreed, and then we did it. So that's the way that worked. I mean, I did outlines, so that we knew what we were doing. But that's the way that worked. For the project that I'm hoping to announce really soon, it's been great to work with an editor, because that was a project that I thought I understood. And I thought I had a really great grasp on, but the editor asked me like 3 really good questions and made me rethink a lot of stuff, and it's so much better now. So, ideally you get an editor who can see what it is that the project can be. You get the best pitch you can, the best outline you can, and then you work on it with the editor to make it even better.
Rather than rushing into trying to finalize a perfect draft before the publisher has sort of had any input at all. Yeah? I know, it's a little echoey. Out to me, a really great artist who I've admired, and he was like, hey, you want to try to figure out something to do together? And I was like, yes. And
And then I just like threw a bunch of ideas at him, and then he picked one.
Absolutely.
And that's what we're gonna do, you know? So finding an artist who's passionate about whatever you're doing, you know, and gets it, that's just solid gold.
Yeah, and then I guess, you know, finding a partner who's
gonna
be able to work with you, whether it's a co-writer or a collaborator or artist, you know, if it's, find someone to complement, you know, your strengths and weaknesses. Like, I cannot write a fight scene to save my life. I am so bad at it. It's just like, I have to sit there for ages, honestly, to come with, like, anything visually interesting. So, you know, being able to trust in a partner on a project, you know, to know that they can come with these, you know, these brilliant ideas that can keep, you know, like, that momentum going, is really wonderful. I mean, you know, you're essentially the parents of the story, and so you want it to have, you know, the best chance possible. So you don't want to, you know, be directorial or, you know, or anything of, like, highway, you want to be able to bring your virtues together to create, you know, a book that's going to exceed you both.
All right. We can only take a couple more questions. We're going to wrap up, unfortunately. The panel's coming to an end, but if we can, yeah, we can just get two more. Is that okay? I'm so sorry, guys.
How hard is it to have both at the same time, a book and a novel writing, like, coinciding with each other?
I'm doing that right now. Literally right now, I'm working on all my comic scripts and writing a pretty significant novel at the same time. And it's the first time in a long time that I felt really challenged by writing stuff. I'm generally quite fast, and I can kind of, it all works, but they seem to use, at least maybe it's not the same thing as everybody else, but for me they seem to use really different muscles. Prose and comics are just different things, and so snapping myself out of one into the other has been challenging.
They're the same story. Translating over both mediums.
I think,
I wrote a short story when I was a comic journalist to work with an artist that fell through, but I really liked the story.
I wanted to turn it into a novel. Well, like any adaptation, I think you've got to understand what the strength of that medium is, and that it's going to go through permutations of that, right? Comics are a visual medium, you know. Although there are times you can make a talking head scene work, but it's kind of nice if there's a stronger visual hook, generally speaking. So it's about looking and saying, does this story still function? And if not, what can we do to enhance it for that particular medium? The great thing is with prose, you can get into people's heads easier. Paint a much more particular picture in that, you know, kind of prose way, like you can really dig in on a description in a way that you wouldn't on a comic, but there's other sort of weaknesses you gotta sort of work around.
Thank you.
No problem.
I read a while back about a writer in DC who's suing for creative
property. Right, like for ownership. Right.
So I wanted to know, if you were to do a story about, let's say, you gave an example about kind of crop being used in a branch or an extraction of Batman itself and trying to get intellectual property from that own character. How would you go about it? Like you said, you would have made some decisions back then about doing things differently. How would you go about doing something like that, involving another character, but sticking to your own creation of it?
Right.
Are you talking about the legal aspect, or are you talking about
threading the needle? It can be a challenge, right? Because anything you write for DC Marvel is owned by DC Marvel, and there are some situations which you would get sort of participation if the character is used in another way, like if somebody I made up is used in Avengers 9 or whatever, then that could be a good thing for me financially, hypothetically, right? But honestly, there's a hard line rule, and it's very straightforward. If you've got something awesome that you love, and you know that is yours and you've made up, think very long and hard about giving it to DC Marvel, because you're giving it away, and they're not going to give you that much more for it. If it's something that's a serious home run idea, that could be something amazing. Which I, you know, like Letter 44 is, I felt like that for me, right? I would not have given that to Marvel and DC, right? Be very careful with giving your big original ideas away unless you're sure you'd be well compensated for them. That said, if you're only giving D-plus level ideas to Marvel and DC, you're not going to get work from Marvel and DC. So it's a very difficult balance.
Part of your job as a writer is to come up with ideas.
Yep.
And yes, you're going to filter that through and you're going to make decisions about what's creator-owned and what's commercial.
Yep.
But you're going to make a career that's based on the quality of your ideas and the consistency of it. You know, every so often I think people, they say their name, they talk about they want to be a writer, and maybe they have a story in their heads or whatever, but most of the time I get the feeling they want to have written. What they want to do is they want to sign books. They want to autograph something, but the actual hard work and the development and the blood, sweat, and tears that goes into it is really the difficult thing that they're not necessarily ready for. They don't know how much it's going to take. And I'm not saying that every idea is equal, but you got to put good ideas out for work for hire, you got to put good ideas out for your own creator on stuff, and if you're a writer and you want to do this passionately, you got to consistently keep doing it. You got to keep building it, and hopefully, you know, improve that you're not a flash in the pan or a one-shot idea.
It's sort of an experience thing. The more you do it, the better you get at being able to tell which one to give and not to give, and what's to hold back. And, I mean, it's one of the hardest parts, but, you know, you get better out of the time.
It's also just a gut thing. I mean, there are certain stories that I've saved, like this project I'm talking about that I've had for 22 years. I've saved that for myself. At the same time, I freely give everything I have to my creator at work. You know what I mean? Like, every idea that I come up with that will work for Superman, I'm giving to Superman. Because that's
like
the only way.
It's for Superman.
It's for Superman.
You know what I mean? Yeah. The idea that works for Superman.
Right, exactly.
Context.
Yeah. But I'm not, but I have to give it everything in order to make it good.
Or
you know what I mean?
So, like, you just, if you're not, you know, you have to be A+ to do it, right?
Sweet. All right, we got to wrap it up. Thank you so much, everyone. We appreciate the support. Come see us, come chat with us, come ask us questions.
Once again, it's Amber Love back with you at amberunmasked.com, and that was the last panel that I have from Special Edition New York. And coming up next with Vodka O'Clock, you'll hear from another really great convention. At least I thought it was a really great convention. But remember that you can keep up with everything else, all the news coverage and recaps for things at amberunmasked.com. You can sponsor the show and the website at patreon.com/amberunmasked for as little as $1 per week. So thanks for listening. Don't forget that you can find me on Twitter @ElizabethAmber. If you have any questions, you can leave them in the comments for this show.